വെൽക്കം ടു ഒറീസ സ്റ്റേറ്റ് ഓപ്പൺ യൂണിവേഴ്സിറ്റി ഇന്റർനെറ്റ് റേഡിയോ പ്രജ്ഞാവാണി.
ഹലോ എവ്രി വൺ, മൈ നെയിം ഇസ് അശിത് കുമാർ ശ്രീവാസ്തു. ഐ ആം എൻ അസിസ്റ്റന്റ് പ്രൊഫസർ ഓഫ് ലോ അറ്റ് നാഷണൽ ലോ യൂണിവേഴ്സിറ്റി ഒറീസ. ഐ എം ഓഫറിംഗ് കോഴ്സസ് ഓൺ കോൺസ്റ്റിറ്റ്യൂഷണൽ ലോ ആൻഡ് ഓൺ ഡേറ്റാ പ്രൊട്ടക്ഷൻ ലോ. ഐ എം ഓൾസോ ഓഫറിംഗ് എ കോഴ്സ് ഓൺ ബേസിക്സ് ഓഫ് ഇന്ത്യൻ കോൺസ്റ്റിറ്റ്യൂഷൻ അറ്റ് ഒറീസ സ്റ്റേറ്റ് ഓപ്പൺ യൂണിവേഴ്സിറ്റി. അണ്ടർ ടുഡേയ്സ് ലെക്ചർ ഐ ഷാൽ ബി ഡിസ്കസിംഗ് അബൌട്ട് ആർട്ടിക്കൽ 13 ഓഫ് ഇന്ത്യൻ കോൺസ്റ്റിറ്റ്യൂഷൻ. If anyone who has read Article 13 of Indian Constitution, he'll come to realize one fact, that you cannot find anything like this in any other constitution. If you read Clause 1 of Article 13, you'll come to realize it talks about pre-constitutional laws. Now, what are pre-constitutional laws? These are those laws which are made prior to the commencement of the Constitution. And any law made prior to the commencement of the Constitution, which is going against the fundamental right, it shall be void to the extent it is going against the fundamental right. It creates a principle, the principle of severability. What is severability now? The idea of severability is of cutting down those portions of laws which are going against the fundamental right. Let's take an example. If there is an enactment with having 10 sections in that act, and 5 of those sections are going against the fundamental right, we shall sever those 5 sections and make sure the other 5 sections remain intact. And that's the idea of severability. You're cutting down only those portions of an act which are going against the fundamental right, not the whole act. Now, if you read Clause 2 of Article 13, you come to realize that the Clause 2 of Article 13 talks about post-constitutional laws, not the pre-constitutional laws. It says the state shall not make any law. And that's quite an impediment on the state. The parliament cannot make any law which is going against the fundamental right. It's an absolute prohibition. Howsoever, if you read Clause 2, Article 13 quite closely, you come to realize something more. The Article 13, Clause 2 is more than Clause 1. Why? Because it talks about two things. The state cannot make any law. At the same time, if the state makes any law which is going against the fundamental right, it shall be void to the extent it is going against the fundamental right. So it is preventive and remedial in nature. It prevents the parliament from making any law. At the same time, it remedies those laws which are going against the fundamental right. And that's why there are two principles coming into existence. The principle of severability, which we already discussed. The severability is a principle of severing those portions of law going against the fundamental right, and the doctrine of eclipse. Now, what is doctrine of eclipse? I hope you have heard about the story of the Superman. Who is the Superman? A Superman is a DC comic character who is all powerful. He's the greatest hero of all, who can fight anyone, who can fly. But Superman has one small problem to it. The problem is regarding kryptonite. Whenever kryptonite comes close to Superman, he does not have any kind of power. The same goes with the idea of eclipse. Till the time there is existence of a fundamental right, any law going against that fundamental right becomes passive in nature. And the moment that fundamental right is removed, that act becomes active again. And that's the idea of eclipse. You're eclipsing those laws which are going against the fundamental right. And the moment that fundamental right is removed, that particular law becomes active again. And that's the principle of doctrine of eclipse. If you want to understand the doctrine of severability, I would recommend that you should read the case of RMDC versus Union of India. It's a 1957 case judgment. Under paragraph 7, you shall know the guidelines as to how severability has to be applied. If you want to know what is doctrine of eclipse, I would recommend you should read the case of Bhikaji versus State of MP. It's a great case about eclipse, as to how eclipse has to be applied. There's another principle regarding as to how these principles have to be applied, the principle of prospective application. Keep in mind, all these laws which are made prior to the commencement of the Constitution, they were made at a time when there was no fundamental right. So we do not know if there will be a fundamental right or not. So those laws were made at a time where there were no fundamental right. That means those laws were valid at that time when they were made. To make sure those laws are still in existence, to make sure that those laws are to be applied, we see there's prospective application. What is prospective application? Let us take an example. On 8 November 2016, the government of India banned the notes of 500 rupees and 1000 rupees. Something happened on that day. We also stood at the line of the ATMs that I totally understand. Apart from that, other thing happened. From 8 November 2016, from 12 o'clock, all the notes of 500 and 1000 were banned. That means what? From 9th November, all those notes cannot be used. What does this mean? This means prospective application. Those notes are not banned from the initial time when they were made, but those are banned from 9th November. That means prospective application. Similarly, when I am applying the principle of severability or eclipse, it shall have prospective application, not retrospective. It shall be banned or void from the date it is held to be void. not from the deed, it was made. Keeping all this in mind, now we need to understand as to what is the law. Because if you see Article 13 Clause 1, it talks about law made pre-constitutionally. If you see Article 13 Clause 2, it talks about law post-constitutionally. Now we need to understand what are laws. In order to understand what are laws, we need to look at Article 13 Clause 3 Subclause A, which defines law. It says law shall include ordinance, order, bylaws, rules, regulation, custom, notification, and usage having the force of law in India. That means what? Now keep in mind, this is not an exhaustive definition, but this brings in an ambiguity for us as to what can be regarded as law or not. One of the biggest ambiguity regarding the laws is regarding personal laws. Should we regard personal laws as laws or not? For example, should we regard Hindu personal law as law or not? Should we regard Muslim personal law as law or not? Or should we regard Christian personal laws as law or not? Now there's a question regarding this. If you regard all these personal laws as law defined under Article 13 Clause 3 Subclause A, that means any personal law going against the fundamental right shall be void. Then what is triple talaq? Then what is nikah halala? Why do we have nikah halala? If they are going against the idea of fundamental right, that means we do not recognize personal laws as laws. The Supreme Court of India has adopted a very safe pattern. They say, you know what, we shall not intervene in personal laws. But a question came up in 2017 in the case of Saraya Banu versus Union of India, the question regarding triple talaq. Whether triple talaq is a personal law or whether it is a law as defined under Article 13, Clause 3, Subclause A. If you read the judgment, the dissenting opinion delivered by the Chief Justice at that time, Justice Khair and Abdul Nazir, you come to realize they say that triple talaq is valid. They say the reason behind that is because triple talaq is not a law as defined under Article 13, Clause 3, Subclause A, but it is a personal law. And because Supreme Court of India never interferes in personal laws, you cannot challenge the validity of that particular action. But if you read the majority opinion, you come to realize there's something more to the idea. For the majority, they said that triple talaq is a statutory law, a law enacted by a British colonial state. How did they say that? They said the triple talaq is defined under Section 2 of Shariat Application Act 1937. That means what? Triple talaq has been defined under an act. An act is a law. And if you do not agree with me, read Article 13, Clause 3, Subclause B. You come to realize any kind of legislative act done by the pre-constitutional or the post-constitutional shall be regarded as a law under Article 13, Clause 3, Subclause A and Subclause B. And for that very reason, triple talaq became a part of a law as defined under Article 13, Clause 3, Subclause A. And that's why triple talaq was held invalid under Article 13, Clause 1. Now we come to the fourth question, the question regarding as to whether constitutional amendments are law or not. If you see Article 13, Clause 4, it was added by 24th Amendment 1971. It says amendments are not law, but there's a history behind this. Keep in mind, the constitutions have two caretakers. One is the Parliament, one is the Supreme Court of India, and they both fight for their sovereignty upon it. Parliament says, I have the sole right to amend the constitution, whereas the Supreme Court says, you know what, I am the last interpreter of constitution, so I have the custody of the constitution. Under this fight, the first case which we are discussing is the case of Shankari Prasad versus Union of India. Under this particular case, this question came up, whether amendments are law or not. So the court said, you know what, amendments are not law. So the sole reason being, if you regard amendments as a law, there's a problem to it. Because if you regard amendment as a law, the parliament cannot make any kind of law which is going against the fundamental right. That means you're making the constitution static in nature. We need to have a dynamic constitution. So you cannot stop the parliament from making amendments to the constitution. The next case regarding this was Sajjan Singh versus State of Rajasthan, 1965. Under this particular case, they said the same thing. Amendments are not law. Howsoever, a concurring opinion delivered by Justice Mudalkar, he asked a question. Tell me something. If you're giving them absolute power to amend to the parliament, what if they amend the constitution and say, we are a dictatorial state and not a democratic state? Do you give the absolute power to the parliament? Wouldn't that be risky in nature? Under paragraph 57 of his judgment, Justice Mudalkar says this, you know what? There are certain basic essential features of Indian constitution which cannot be taken away. Keep this in mind. This is important for us right now. We move to the third case, the case of IC Golaknath versus State of Punjab, 1967, where they overruled the case of Shankari Prasad and Sajjan Singh. And they said, you know what? Amendments are a law. They said, it is not written anywhere under Article 368, the provision providing for amendments, that the power stays with the parliament to amend the constitution. That means that power is not with the parliament. That means it's not an absolute power. The parliament does not have a power to amend the constitution where it is affecting the fundamental rights. And if they do that, any kind of amendment made by them shall be subject to Article 13, Clause 2. Now, this created an uproar in whole of India, because the amending power has been taken away from the parliament. Now, what happens? If the parliament cannot amend the constitution, that means the constitution becomes static in nature. We need to make sure that the parliament is dynamic in nature. The needs of the people are changing every time. So to overrule the effect of IC Goloknath, we had a 24th Amendment 1971, which said quite clearly under Article 13, Clause 4, amendments are not law. Now, the validity of this particular amendment also was challenged in the case of Keshananda Bharati versus State of Kerala, 1973, a 13-judge bench case. The majority opinion delivered by 13 judges, they said resoundingly that, you know what, the amending power is with the parliament. Howsoever, they realize one fact, they cannot give the absolute power to the parliament. Because if the parliament has absolute power, they will amend the constitution as per their own liking. To make sure there is a backing behind that, to make sure there is a leash on the parliament, they came up with the idea of basic structure. The idea of basic structure came in with a ratio of 7:6, with 6 judges saying that there is no such thing as basic structure, and 7 saying, you know what, there is. By barely we have basic structure today. If the 7th one has said, you know what, we do not have it, today we won't have the idea of basic structure. And somewhere down the line, the credit needs to go to Justice Mudalkar in Sajjan Singh, who gave the idea of essential principle of Indian Constitution, which became the basis for the idea of basic structure of Indian Constitution today. So that's it for today, for the idea of Article 13. By the next lecture, we shall be completing Article 14, 15, 16, 17, the idea of equality code and affirmative action in India. That's it for today. Thank you so much.